We now come to Genesis chapter 20. I apologize that we had to go so rapidly through the last verses of chapter 19 about Lot and his daughters. But I don't know that it's the kind of material that we want to dwell on anyway. It's not all that edifying. But it does close down the story of Lot. One thing at a time gets peeled off of Abraham's life. You know, Lot was there originally, and he got eliminated. Ishmael gets eliminated pretty soon in chapter 21. And then by chapter 23, Sarah is out of his life. And so as he walked with God, he walked more and more alone with God, as it were. The persons close to him were taken from him or separated from him at various stages in his walk till he had nothing but God left. And that is actually not unmerciful of God to do. I mean, it sounds kind of harsh to take away so many family members, but of course, once one finds that they find their whole happiness in God, that they find that they're really in a much better place and much more happy place, really, than when their happiness is found in people or other things. Now, in chapter 20, we have a really disappointing chapter. It's not clear whether this chapter and the story in it are related in the proper chronological order. If so, it's strange because Sarah at this point would be pregnant with Isaac. And Isaac is born in the next chapter. But in chapter 20, Abram ends up doing something very much like what he did in chapter 12. In chapter 12, there was a famine in the land of Canaan, and in order to secure food for his household, Abram went down to Egypt, and there he lied about his wife, said she was his sister, and she almost got defiled, but God apparently intervened, plagued Pharaoh's household, and Sarah got back safely to Abraham, although both of them were a bit humbled by the exposure to the exposure of their ruse. Well, we have a similar thing happening in chapter 20. More detail is given. It's a different land, a different king, but very much the same kind of story. Similar enough, in fact, that those who believe that Moses did not write the Pentateuch, but that it was just various traditions intermingled, have thought maybe this and chapter 12 were two different traditions of the same event, but conflicting with each other on details. That is not necessary to believe. What this story apparently tells us is that even a man in his more advanced walk with the Lord is capable, if he's not wise and not walking in the Spirit, capable of making the same mistakes he made when he was younger. You never really reach the age where you are immune to making stupid mistakes or falling into sin. You may become very sanctified by a habit of living a holy life for years, but that you can never just rest on your laurels and say, well, I'm now too mature to make the mistakes I made when I was young. Steve Waterman was telling me last night about a well-known leader in the Calvary Chapel movement, certainly not, probably not anyone you'd heard of, not one of the best-known leaders, but one that I had heard of, who was in his 60s, and he'd been a tremendous minister and traveled the world and did a great deal of ministry, and he ran off with some young woman from his wife, and he's in his 60s. And, you know, you hear of that happening too often anyway, but it's so surprising when it's somebody who seems to really have been a Christian a long time and matured in the Lord and an older man and so forth. And it makes us all be on our guard that you might say, well, I'd be vulnerable to that kind of thing when I'm, you know, a baby Christian, but not when I'm an older Christian. Well, you can walk with God all your life, but still at the end of your life, as at the beginning, you have to always be on your guard. You always have to be obedient. You have to be submitted. You have to be trusting. You can always fall. Your sinful nature will never really be gone, and you will never be incapable of sinning. And Abram's a good example of that. Here he is, very advanced in years. He's actually passed some tests of faith already and failed others. Here we see him making the same mistake he made right at the beginning of his life with God. And Abraham journeyed from there to the south, that is to the Negev. and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur, and sojourned in Gerar. Now, Gerar was one of the five Philistine city-states in the region. And we're not told exactly why he did that, why he stayed there. It may have been for commerce reasons. Again, he was a traveling chieftain with probably a commercial caravan of sorts. I mean, he had a lot of livestock. He didn't eat them all himself. He probably sold them and traded them. And I mean, he had to do something all those years that he was waiting for God to show up with the next instructions. And so he may have periodically parked his caravan near certain populated areas in order to do business there. And that might be why he was in the region of Gerar, though we don't know. We certainly don't have any reason to believe God directed him there specifically. Now, Abraham said to Sarah, or of Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, the king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God gave to Abimelech in a dream by night, came to him in a dream by night, and said to him, "Indeed, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." But Abimelech had not come in near her and said, "Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also? Did he not say to me, 'She is my sister'? And she herself said, 'He is my brother.' In the integrity of my heart and innocence of my hands, I have done this." And God said to him in a dream, "Yes, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart, for I also withheld you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours." So Abimelech rose early in the morning, called his servants, and told all these things in their hearing. And the men were very afraid. And Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "Why have you done this? How have I offended you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done deeds to me that ought not to be done." Then Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you have in view that you have done this thing?" And Abraham said, "Because I thought, 'Surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife. But indeed, she is truly my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And it came to pass, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said to her, 'This is your kindness that you should do for me. In every place, wherever we go, say of me, "He is my brother."'" Then Abimelech took sheep, oxen, and male and female servants, and gave them to Abraham, and he restored Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, "See, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you." Then to Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Indeed, this vindicates you before all who are with me, before all others." Thus she was reproved. So Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his maidservants. Then they bore children. For the Lord had closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Now notice Abimelech already had a wife, because it mentions that God opened the wombs of Abimelech's wife and his maidservants' wombs also. And these maidservants may have been concubines. We don't know. Abimelech may have had only one legal wife at this point, but he was taking Sarah in to be another. So he obviously had no problems about polygamy. And he probably, these wombs of Abimelech's servants being closed probably wouldn't affect him so much unless they were his concubines and he was hoping to have children by them. This is the way that God had judged Abimelech. In the case of chapter 12, God judged Pharaoh a different way, just brought plagues on his house. This case, he just closed the wombs. That's a judgment. Again, in biblical times, having children was considered a blessing, and a lot of them, a bigger blessing. And for God to close the womb, which the Bible also makes clear God does, God opens and he closes the womb. It's not for people to decide when a child will come into existence. People can try and try to have a child and never obtain one. And people can try desperately to avoid having a child and yet have one. It is God who opens the womb or closes it. The Bible clearly teaches that here and elsewhere. But this story doesn't really give us too much new. It's kind of interesting, the interaction between Abimelech and God. in this dream that God came to him in, because we don't have any similar aspect in the story of Pharaoh taking Sarah in chapter 12. We don't read of God speaking to Pharaoh there, only cursing him. But Abimelech protests that he shouldn't be judged for this thing because he was ignorant of the fact that he was sinning. And God acknowledged it and said, well, therefore I kept you from sinning against me. He had not yet touched Sarah, obviously, and therefore he did not commit adultery. But he would have, and when God said, you are a dead man to him, when he spoke to him and said that to him in verse 3, he obviously meant you are in danger of coming under the death sentence from me. You haven't done anything yet, but you're on a course of action that will certainly result in death. By the way, this I take to be a good example of what the Bible means when it says that before we were saved, we were dead in trespasses and sins. we were not really physically dead. Although some people try to make an issue of that and say, how can a dead man ever repent or have faith? And even suggest that you can't without God making you do so. that's making too much of a metaphor. When Paul said we were dead in trespasses and sins, I think it's the same thing as saying to Abimelech, you're a dead man. Why? Because he's on a course of sin for which he will be judged with death if he does not repent. That's the course we were on when we were unsaved. We were dead in that same sense. Not that we had already died, but we were on that path. And so Abimelech's ignorance did not necessarily make him... If he had gone ahead and slept with Sarah, it would have still been a sin. But because of his ignorance about it, God didn't let him do so. So it's clear that God honored the fact that the man was acting ignorantly in a way that he would not if he was acting deliberately. If he had deliberately taken another man's wife, God would have gone ahead and let him go through with the sin and judged him with death. But God warned him because he knew the man's integrity. And what's interesting is that Abram later said the reason he fooled these people is because he said in verse 11, surely I thought the fear of God is not in this place. Well, he sure was wrong about that, because Abimelech was very much afraid when God spoke to him. And he had the fear of God. And it says even his whole household were afraid. In verse 8, so Abimelech rose early in the morning, called his servants, and told all these things in their hearing, and the men were very afraid. The fear of God was very much in the place. Abraham misjudged them. And because he misjudged them, he ended up lying and endangering Sarah. And if she was pregnant with Isaac at this time, but not yet showing, that would be an amazing thing that he would even take such a risk with his wife. It is possible that this story is related not in its chronological order. It may have happened at an earlier point and only be mentioned here because we don't always know that the stories are related in exactly the order they occurred. Sarai at this time, or Sarah, was 90 years old, if this is in its proper order. And for her to be taken into a harem at age 90 seems rather old to be found attractive, especially if the king only had one other wife and he wasn't collecting all the women he saw, and he selected her of all the people in his kingdom to want. It sounds like she had more than ordinary attractiveness even at age 90. Some people have suggested that in order to make her capable of bearing a child, God had rejuvenated her, that she had perhaps been older and more haggard before God began to work the work of making a mother out of her. And since she had been 90, obviously her organs, as she was past menopause, she had to have some renovation of her organs in order to conceive and bear a child and so forth. And her breasts would have to be able to take milk and so forth. And there was obviously some things about her body that had to be rejuvenated in order for her at that age to be capable of bearing and nursing a child. And some have felt that this rejuvenating process was more complete than just those few items, but that he just made her like a younger woman. But also, we remember, she died at age 127, which might have been, since Abraham lived to be 175, her dying at 127 might have been similar to someone dying at age 60 today, something like that. People may have lived approximately twice as long. Abram dying at 175 would be like what someone dying in their 80s now, and Sarah then would be dying like a woman dying in her 60s. And that was 30 years after this. She could have been comparable, even without any miraculous rejuvenation, could have been comparable to a woman in her mid-40s. And again, if exceptionally beautiful, the mid-40s are not an age where either men or women are necessarily decrepit. I say that as a man who's now 44. And obviously I'm not decrepit, right? Tell me I'm not decrepit. I feel so decrepit sometimes. But she was probably not comparable to 90-year-olds generally. A woman in her mid-40s might be postmenopausal, as she was, but not necessarily very far gone down that road to decrepitness. I don't really want to comment much more on this story, just because it resembles so closely the earlier story, and there are much more important stories coming up. There's no clear lesson in this story that is unique to it, except, as I said, perhaps the lesson that a man can make the same mistakes if he's not careful, if he's not trusting God moment by moment. He can make the same stupid mistakes as an old believer that he made as a young believer. And therefore, we shouldn't put much stock in years, but we need to make sure that we don't get careless and think we're too spiritual to make certain mistakes just because we've been Christians a long time. Chapter 21, the story continues more along the important lines that it left off in chapter 18. And the Lord visited Sarah, as he had said. And the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore him, Isaac. Now God had told Abraham and Sarah that they were going to have a child named Isaac. Isaac means laughter. And you will recall that both Abraham and Sarah, when they heard first that this child would be born, they laughed. And they didn't laugh for joy, as some commentators like to say, trying to make it sound like they didn't lack faith. They did lack faith initially. They didn't see how it could be possible that they, at their age, could have a child. It would require a miracle, an unheard of miracle, unprecedented. And it seemed laughable and ludicrous. So God told them, you're going to name the child Laughter. And the reason for that is that every time you call this child by name, you'll be reminded that you laughed. And you'll be reminded that the thing that I promised was ludicrous, that it was impossible, that it was unthinkable. And yet here it is before your eyes. You'll be reminded every time you call him Laughter that it seemed incredible, and yet here he is. And so they named him, as God said to, Laughter, Isaac. Then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him, and Sarah said, God has made me to laugh, so that all who hear will laugh with me. So now she's laughing for joy, and those are going to share her joy when they hear about it. It also will seem funny to them. She also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? For I have borne him a son in his old age. So the child grew and was weaned. And Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. Apparently a celebration feast of the weaning of the child. Seems like the mother would be the one who celebrates that. But anyway, I guess it was one of those rites of passage for a child, like bar mitzvah at age 13. There was the weaning ceremony, so he threw a big party to celebrate the weaning. Can you imagine a big old party with his 318 servants? That's the men, and then the female servants. Hundreds of people had a big party. What are you partying about? The baby's weaned, you know? But, I mean, this is an important baby. I mean, everything about this baby's life was important, so they have a big party when he's weaned. Now Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac. And the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. That is because of Ishmael. He loved Ishmael too, you know. Ishmael, well, depending on what age they weaned Isaac, but I've heard that in those days and in those lands, to wean a child at age somewhere between 3 and 5 was not unheard of. Now, 5 sounds awfully late to wean a child by our thinking, But I've heard that it has been done. And occasionally you'll see in National Geographic specials these tribal women with their five-year-olds hanging on their breasts. You know, I mean, it's in our society, women want to get the baby off the breast as soon as they can, like in 2 weeks, you know, put them on formula or something like that, which is, by the way, not very good for the baby. There's reasons why God has provided breast milk for babies. It's more healthy for them. It provides them with antibodies and things that strengthen them in life. And I don't know, maybe weaning them 3 years would be good for them. I've never known a woman in our society here who weans them really 3 years. My wife thought she was going to because she loved nursing the babies. In fact, she even was still nursing Benjamin when Hannah was born 2 years later. And she was nursing two babies at once, 2 years different in age. But she didn't wean him until he was three. I mean, she didn't nurse him until he was three. She weaned him before that. But I'm saying the reason I'm calculating the age of Isaac at this point is because it impacts on the age of Ishmael. Ishmael must have been 14 when Isaac was born. And if Isaac was, say, even 2 years old when he was weaned, then Ishmael would have been at least 16 years old. More likely, Isaac was three or maybe even more. So when we talk about Ishmael mocking this situation, we're not talking about a little kid mocking something. We're talking about a guy who's practically a man. He's 17, maybe 18 years old, Ishmael. Now, why would he be mocking? What's so funny about a baby being weaned? Well, it seems like Ishmael, of course, bore some real hostility toward Isaac, and understandably so. Ishmael had been the only child for 13 years. And being an only child in this case didn't just mean that he had all of his father's affection. It meant that he had all of his father's estate to inherit. And the man was one of the wealthiest men in the area. I mean, Ishmael stood to become an extremely wealthy chieftain after his very old father would pass away. And now there was somebody else who's not only going to share, but going to take the inheritance. Ishmael is now a nobody. Ever since this baby came along, the position that Ishmael had known all of his childhood years up until age 13 was suddenly usurped by another person, and Ishmael was now persona non grata. He was just the outcast of the family. I mean, he was there, but he was just the son of a slave. And Isaac was everything that Ishmael had once been, had supplanted him. And so Ishmael, no doubt, had a great deal of bitterness and anger and hostility and rivalry that he felt toward Isaac. He didn't dare do anything toward the little guy, but he obviously scorned any celebration over the baby and was mocking and probably making cynical remarks of bitter comments and so forth. And Sarah got wind of that, and she just, that was the last straw. That she probably never did much like having Ishmael in the house anyway. He wasn't really hers. And now that she had her own child, it made it all the more galling to her to see him, and then to see him mocking her child. That she's just got this anger toward him, and she tells Abraham, that get rid of this child. Get rid of this young man, really. And as you read the story, you don't get the impression you're reading about a young man 16, 17 years old. As a matter of fact, his mother is much tougher than he is, as we shall see as the story goes on. But Sarah insists that Ishmael be ejected from the family. And Abraham was displeased initially. But God said to Abraham in verse 12, do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of the bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. Not Ishmael, in other words. Your seed that I have made promises concerning will come through Isaac, not through Ishmael. Yet I will also make a nation of the son of the bondwoman, because he is your seed. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water, and putting it on her shoulder, he gave it and the boy to Hagar, and sent her away. Then she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water in the skin was used up, and she placed the boy under one of the shrubs. She put him there. He's a man, young man, practically in his prime, and she's an old woman by now, but she's holding up better than he is. She puts him under a shrub, then she went and sat down across from him at a distance of about a bow shot, for she said to herself, "Let me not see the death of the boy." So she sat opposite him and lifted her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad. Now, the voice of the woman was weeping, but the lad was apparently weeping louder or whatever. And God heard his voice. Then the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said to her, "What ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him with your hand, for I will make him a great nation." And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. Then she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. So God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness, and he became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt, which is where Hagar herself was from. So the people who came from Ishmael were three-quarters Egyptian, because Ishmael was half Egyptian, his mother was Egyptian, and his wife was full Egyptian, and he was only half Hebrew from Abraham. So the Arabs, who are believed to have come from Ishmael, no one knows for sure that they did, but it's strongly traditional that they did, are really technically three-quarters Egyptian and only one-quarter Hebrew. I would point out that the lad, as he's here called, seems to be really handling the wilderness much more poorly than his mother. She has to put him under a shrub. He can't position himself there. He apparently is wasted away with thirst and so forth. And we don't know why. Now, maybe it's because of his chivalry. Maybe he insisted that his mother drink all the water, and he didn't take any, and so he wasted away quicker. Or probably it's because she was a slave and had worked hard all her life and was, you know, had to. She didn't have an easy life, but through his entire upbringing, he was pampered. He was the only heir of a powerful royal family, as it were, and he probably never had to lift a finger to do anything. He probably had those 300 and something servants, you know, at his beck and call, so he'd never had to face the hardships of life before, and it seems like he was kind of wimpy and soft, although that changed. He acclimated, became a hunter, an archer, and eventually a great nation. And so that's the last we will hear of Ishmael until Abraham dies, and then he'll reappear, and he and Isaac together will bury Abraham. And apparently on friendly terms, though we don't really read any specifics about their attitudes toward one another in that later time. Verse 22, "And it came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, 'God is with you in all that you do. Now therefore swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, with my offspring, or with my posterity, but that according to the like kindness that I have done to you, you will do to me and to the land in which you have sojourned.' And Abraham said, 'I will swear.'" So this was basically a recognition on the part of Abimelech, who had appeared in the previous chapter as the one who had taken Sarah into his harem. Abimelech recognized that the blessing of God was on Abraham, and that it would not be good for Abimelech if Abraham decided to be unfriendly toward him. Abraham was a powerful man with a lot of servants whom he could arm if he needed to and have his way with anyone he made war with. And so Abimelech suggested a mutual non-aggression pact between them and their offspring. This same pact was reaffirmed later with Isaac and Abimelech's son, probably. The same arrangement, same concern was raised. But Abraham took this occasion to reprove Abimelech about an old grievance that Abraham had nursed against Abimelech but had never brought up. It says, "Then Abraham reproved Abimelech because of a well of water which Abimelech's servants had seized. And Abimelech said, 'I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, nor had I heard of it until today.'" So, sort of like Clinton, every time some criminal thing is raised against him, "I didn't know about it until I read it in the papers." So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. And Abraham set 7 ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. And Abimelech asked Abraham, what is the meaning of these seven ewe lambs which you have set by themselves? And he said, you will take these seven ewe lambs from my hand, that they may be my witness that I have dug this well. Therefore he called the place Beersheba, which means the well of the oath, because the two of them swore an oath there. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. So Abimelech rose with Phicol, the commander of his army, and they returned to the land of the Philistines. Then Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there he called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. That's Jehovah El Olam, meaning Jehovah, the everlasting God. El Olam is E-L, next word, O-L-A-M. El Olam. Jehovah El Olam means the everlasting God. And Abram sojourned in the land of the Philistines many days. Now, he was still in the land where he had been when Sarah had been taken from him. And this king realized that if Abram was going to stay in the area, that he wanted to make sure Abram wasn't going to try to get back at him for having taken his wife or for any other reason. And when he found out Abram did have a grievance against him over a well that had been seized by Abimelech's servants, Abimelech was quick to want to set that right and settle any grievances that there were. And the exchange of ewe lambs, the exchange of the seven ewe lambs, was simply a visible transaction, which by accepting the ewe lambs, Abimelech was acknowledging that that the well belonged to Abraham. It's as if Abraham was paying him sort of a small fee. It's almost like a, you know, it's hard to know what it's like in our society, but it's like some kind of a small payment was made by Abraham publicly to declare that this well was his, and that by accepting the fee of the seven ewe lambs, this was a witness that Abimelech was acknowledging Abraham's ownership of the well. Wells, by the way, were very, very hard to come by in the desert. Digging wells took a lot of man hours, and they had to be dug very deep because in the desert the water isn't very close to the surface of the ground. And when you've got hundreds of thousands of head of livestock, as well as several hundred people in your household, and they all need water on a daily basis in the desert, you need wells. You need reliable wells, and you need wells that produce a lot of water. And so we, you know, we can just turn on the faucets and water comes down through our city water system. But in the desert, in days where they couldn't do that, and water, they probably had servants who spent their full time just drawing water out of wells because of all the water they needed to feed the flocks and so forth. Now, one of the more hostile things people could do to somebody to really either bother them or endanger them was to fill their wells with dirt. This hadn't happened on this occasion, but later on, Isaac finds that some of Abimelech's people are filling up his wells with dirt. And that's a very nasty thing to do to a guy in that area. Also, disputes over the ownership of a well, obviously, were very important to settle, because water was like gold, better than gold. You can't survive on gold when you don't have enough water. And so these servants of Abimelech had claimed a well, apparently, that Abram's servants had dug, and he had to settle that matter, make sure that there'd be no dispute over that again. And they called it the Well of the Oath, Beersheba, because of the oath made there. And probably the story is told only because Beersheba became an important Jewish city later on, and this gives some background of how it became officially Jewish territory. Remember, Abraham didn't own land in Canaan. And how could he then own a well? Wells are on real estate, and this real estate belonged to somebody, it seems. But apparently maybe it didn't belong to somebody. It was outside of the walled city of Gerar. It was not within the walled cities of anyone else. And apparently all that land out there between the walled cities was kind of no man's land. And if you dug a well there, you might not own the land, but you own the water. You got water rights because you did the work. And so this place later became a significant Jewish city in later history. And this story may be here simply to tell us its heritage, its background, that Abram made an oath here with Abimelech, and that's why the city is called the Well of the Oath. Now, chapter 22, it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here am I. And he said, take now your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Now, here's a bit of bad news. You know, every time that God has appeared to Abram, he's had some more good news for him. And he says, God, you know, Abraham has probably got one ear cocked every day, wondering if God's going to say, Abraham, and he'd say, yes, here I am. Because that's what's happened all the times before, and God always had some new promise to make to him. Only once did he say, circumcise yourself. That was not all that good news. But the other, all the other times God appeared to him was only to make promises to him. So he probably liked hearing from God. And here he hears from God. Abraham, oh yeah, here I am. What is it, God? What news do you have for me now? Well, I want you to take that son of yours and kill him. I want you to offer him up as a sacrifice, a burnt offering to me on a mountain I'm going to tell you about. Now, you know, it's amazing how the story does not in any way describe Abraham's emotional response to this, Abraham's emotional grief, the turmoil it put him in. I mean, the turmoil was of more than one kind. Of course, there was the ordinary turmoil that anyone would feel if they felt like their child was going to die. But there was, in addition to that, the fact that this child in particular had many promises on him from God, that God was going to use this child, make great nations out of him, going to bless all nations in the world through him. And yet this child had not even been married yet, had no children. How could any of the promises of God be realized if Isaac was in fact put to death at this time? Now you might think that Abraham in the back of his mind thought, in order to fulfill his promises, God's going to have to call this off. I'll just play along in the game until God calls it off. And therefore that he never really intended to offer him up. But the book of Hebrews says he did offer up his son, and he did so accounting that God, if necessary, would simply raise Isaac from the dead. Abram knew that for the promises of God to be fulfilled, Isaac would have to live longer than this. And yet, if he was going to kill him, how could this be? And it's in Hebrews chapter 11 that we read exactly what did go through Abram's mind on this occasion. It says in in Hebrews 11:17, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it had been said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. Accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. Now, when it says that Abraham received Isaac from the dead in a figurative sense, it might be referring to the sequel to the story, how the Abram, you know, was about ready to kill him, and then God said, no, don't, and he gave him back to him. And in a sense, it could be said, figuratively speaking, Abram got his son back from the dead. That could be what it's referring to. Although it does say earlier, in verse 12 of Hebrews 11, that therefore from one man, Abram, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky and multitude. He had received Isaac from the dead in the first place, from his own dead body and Sarah's dead womb. If God could give him Isaac in the first place from the deadness of his womb, then he could give him back to him from the dead again, is what perhaps this is saying. He had, in fact, received Isaac, in a figurative sense, from the dead in the first place. Because Abram's body was as good as dead, and Sarah's womb was as good as dead, and yet God had provided that child from that dead source in the first place, so he could give him back from the dead again. It's hard to know exactly how Abram was thinking about this. I mean, even if he thought, well, God can raise him from the dead, what a thing to believe. What a tremendous amount of faith that would take. I mean, if you had a relative who died, and someone said, okay, let's go raise him from the dead, would you have the faith to do it? Would you have the faith to really believe it would happen? Maybe not. You might have trouble having faith for that. And yet, you're aware of cases in history where the dead did rise. Lazarus rose from the dead. Jairus' daughter, Jesus, rose from the dead. Eutychus was raised from the dead. Even in the Old Testament, Elijah and Elisha raised people from the dead. But Abraham never knew of anyone who had ever been risen from the dead. We have precedents for it, and we'd still have trouble believing it. But Abraham never heard of this kind of thing being done. God had never raised the dead before, and he had no record of it. But all he knew was that God's got to do something, and God can do anything. And if I'm going to kill Isaac and God's going to still fulfill his promises, I'm not going to doubt God. I'll just figure, I'll do what God said and I'll leave the consequences with him. Let God figure out how to work out his promises. I'm just going to do what God said. So we see Abram obeying. And this is really the high point of his faith in his whole walk. We're near the end, by the way, of the story of Abraham. He dies in chapter 25, and there's not very many things left to tell in the story of Abraham. We're really near the end of his life at this point. We don't know how near, because we don't know how many years the story in chapter 22 occurred after the story in chapter 21. We had the birth of Isaac when Abram was 100 years old in chapter 21. But how many years have passed now? The next thing we read is 37 years after the birth of Isaac. In chapter 23, Sarah died at 127. Well, she was 90 when Isaac was born. So that's 37 years later she died. So in chapter 21, Isaac was born. In chapter 23, he was 37 years old. But how old was he in chapter 22? This story of the offering of Isaac, we sometimes think of him as a little boy. He might have been, but he could have been anywhere between zero and, well, between weaned, I guess, because he was weaned in chapter 21, and 37 years old, which he was in chapter 23. I believe there's a Hebrew tradition that he was in his mid-30s or early 30s when this happened. It's a little harder to picture the story being carried out with Isaac being a full-grown man, but it's not impossible that that is the case. It's been very common for Christians to see in this story a picture of Christ, Isaac being a picture of Christ, Abraham being a picture of the Father offering his son. There are many reasons to suggest that this is intentional, that God has intended for us to see it that way. I'll call attention to them as we go through. But let me just say in the first place that Isaac was the promised seed of Abraham. Christ is said to be the seed of Abraham in the New Testament, the one to whom the promises apply. So Isaac, in a sense, is a type of Christ. He will be seen, I think, also as a type of Christ in chapter 24 when we talk about the bride for Isaac that is sought. There is good reason to see Isaac in his relationship with Abraham as a type of Christ in relationship to the Father. And here Abraham intends to offer his son up. And as we read the story, there will be many points where there seems to be a type of Christ being offered up by his father here. It says in verse 3, So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him, servants, and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. Now, this is interesting, Abraham's obedience here. He got early in the morning to do this horrible task. It doesn't say whether he told Sarah what he was doing. I don't think he did. I doubt if she would have let him do it. I mean, she probably physically would have done something to prevent him from doing this. But he just got up early. He didn't wait around till noon to see if God changed his mind, give different instructions. He didn't wait around. He wasn't slow to obey on this most gruesome and unpleasant assignment. And he had servants. Here he's a wealthy man with hundreds of servants, but he splits the wood himself that he intends to start the fire with to burn his son. He's accepting the full weight of this trial. A 100-year-old, 100-and-something-year-old man who has servants at his beck and call doesn't go out and split his own firewood. But Abraham did. And he saddled a donkey, took some servants along. And it says in verse 4, Then on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. That means that for 3 days, as far as Abraham was concerned, his son was as good as dead. God told him, and then 3 days later, he got to the place where, of course, eventually he got his son back that day. Well, he didn't know he was going to, though. In his mind, he made that 3-day trip thinking of his son as dead. Just as Jesus was dead for 3 days before he was restored to his father. So Abraham said to his young men, Stay here with the donkey. the lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you. Now notice his statement, we will come back to you. Yet he fully intended to kill his son and burn him as a burnt offering. That means there'd be nothing left to bring down. And this perhaps is where the writer of Hebrews got the impression of what was going through Abraham's mind. The writer of Hebrews got it from somewhere, probably from the scriptures. This gives the impression that Abraham must have believed that something would happen. He would offer his son and somehow God would raise him from the dead and he'd come back down the mountain with him. He told the servants to expect him and the son back. So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. So Isaac carries the wood to his own execution, just like Jesus, for a certain portion of the time as he walked toward his own crucifixion. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. But Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, "My father." And he said, "Here am I, my son." And he said, "Look, the fire and the wood. But where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" So Isaac was totally uninformed about this, and how Abraham's heart must have been wrenched just to be asked this naive question from his son, whom he knew, but his son didn't know. He was going up to sacrifice him. He says, "Dad, you know, we usually have an animal. We got the fire, we got the wood. Where's the animal?" And Abraham said, "My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering." And the two of them went together. Now, this statement, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering," we know that, well, we'll talk more about that because it is brought up again near the end of the story, the significance of it. In verse 14, it talks about this. I'll refrain from commenting until we get to verse 14 on that comment of Abraham. Then they came to the place of which God had told him. And Abram built an altar there on and placed the wood in order. And he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. Now, of course, by this time, Isaac knew what was going on. How it is that Abraham managed to bind his son is not explained. If the son was a very little child, he may have been able to do so against Isaac's will. But we don't know that Isaac was a little child. Isaac may have been a man. If the Jewish tradition is correct, he might have been about the same age Jesus was when he died. Early 30s. And Jesus died willingly. Jesus submitted to his father's will. There is the possibility that Isaac was an adult, that he saw what his father intended to do now, and, you know, out of respect for his father, although it meant his own death, he just didn't resist. He allowed his father to bind him and go through with this. That's a possibility. It's also, I mean, we don't know what went on. It's so compressed. There's so little detail given. If I was given such a gruesome assignment, I think I would have snuck up behind my son and knocked him out first. I wouldn't want to look into his eyes while I'm thrusting the knife in. You know, I couldn't do it. In which case, that, you know, maybe that happened. All we know is that there was apparently no resistance. Abraham was an old guy at this time, very old. His son may have been in his prime. It's very possible that Isaac was strong and quite capable of resisting his father had he wished to do so. But we read of no resistance. Whether Isaac was overpowered by his father, knocked out, or whatever, we don't know. But all we can say is we do not read of any resistance offered, that Isaac went along with this. Willingly or not, we don't know. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Now, I want to comment on this, where God says, "Now I know that you fear God." This is a verse that's commonly used by people who feel that the Bible teaches that God does not know all the future. There is a group of Christians, they're not just a group, but a certain category, a certain theological system that some Christians hold to, that say that God does know the future of things that he can cause to happen, like the movement of planets or the animal migrations or things that God himself makes happen. But when it comes to the free choices of free moral agents, God cannot coerce or force those, and therefore he can't know in advance what they will be. And to try to prove this point, they have a few scriptures they use. This is one of their favorites. Because God at this point says, now I know. And it sounds as if God's saying, I didn't know until now what you were really going to do, Abraham. I'm really relieved to see that you went through with this. I wasn't sure what you'd do. And now I know. If we were to take these words at face value, then we'd have to say that God did not know before this. Because he said, now I know. However, as I pointed out before, there are multiple cases, even prior to this in Genesis, where the anthropomorphic form that God uses suggests, you know, a degree of ignorance on his part that we know God does not possess. When God came looking for Adam in the garden, he said, where are you, Adam? As if he didn't know. And when he said, I'm in the trees, I'm naked. Why? Did you eat the fruit? You know, like he didn't know. Same thing to Cain. Where is your brother? And likewise, in chapter 18, God said, I've heard things about Sodom. I'm going to go down there, see if it's as bad as I've heard. If it is, then I'll know. Now, these are not cases where God's foreknowledge is in question. It's more his knowledge of present things. If God didn't know where Adam was at the moment, didn't know what had happened to Abel before, did not know yet what things were like currently in Sodom, these are not instances of God not knowing the future. These would be instances of God not knowing what's going on right now, or even what's already happened in the case of Cain slaying Abel. And yet God acted like he didn't know. And we would say these are instances of anthropomorphism, where God's communication, for the sake of communicating with man, he, in a sense, talks as if he were a man. He relates on a human-like level, on a finite level. It's not that God didn't know where Adam was in the bushes or whether he'd eaten of the tree or whether Cain had killed Abel. And it's not as if God, while talking to Abraham, was unaware of how bad Sodom really was. And he had to find out. God is everywhere. God knows everything. And those are not even cases of a question of him knowing the future, but of him knowing the present. Likewise here, it's not really of a question of him knowing future things. He says, now I know that you fear me. He didn't say, now I know what you would do. I didn't know what you'd do until you did it, but now I know. No, he says, now I know that you fear me. Fear of God is something that resided in Abraham or not already. Abraham did what he did because he already feared the Lord. But God acts as if he didn't know until he tested Abraham whether he feared the Lord. This I take to be anthropomorphism, which we cannot press too literally without causing too many other problems in Scripture. We have to admit that God, who is said to know all and be everywhere at once and so forth, at times talks, at least when he appears in human form, he talks as if he was a mere man. And as if he didn't know things that God certainly knew. Why this is done, I don't know, except to say that it makes God a little less overpowering to relate to. I mean, an infinite God relating to finite man would be pretty intimidating unless he came down to our level a certain bit and communed with us like other people. And it sounds like that's what he did. Anyway, God says, I know that you fear me, especially now that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Also, the word know. If you would look it up in the Strong's Concordance in the Hebrew, the word know there has almost, I forget, 20 or 30 different meanings in the Hebrew. If you look at it in the Strong's Dictionary in the back of the Strong's Concordance, the word know. It means a whole variety of things. One of them means show, or to make, literally to make something known, to show it or to demonstrate it. And it's possible that this could mean, now I show that you fear me. Now I have demonstrated by this test. I mean, not that I didn't know whether you feared me or not, but I have provided a demonstration for you, Abraham, and for all who hear this story afterwards, to show that you are a man who fears God. So there's more than one way to take this statement, and it certainly would be reading too much into it to say that God here proves that he didn't know the future until it happened. Verse 13, then Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abram called the name of the place, the Lord will provide. Actually, in the Hebrew, it's Jehovah Jireh. As it is said to this day, in the mountain of the Lord it shall be provided. Now, this is the comment I want to, this is the verse that brings us back to verse 8. In verse 8, Abraham said, the Lord will provide for himself a lamb for a burnt offering. Was this a prophecy about the discovery of this ram? I don't think so. A ram is not a lamb. A lamb is a baby sheep. A ram is an adult male. Abraham predicted that a lamb would be provided for burnt offering. Indeed, God did provide on this occasion an animal, but it wasn't a lamb. And by the way, if God wanted to show Abraham to be a prophet in this, he could have made it a lamb. But then we would have been confused. We would have thought that it was fulfilled already. Remember, it was said back in chapter 20 that Abraham is a prophet. And he prophesied, God's going to provide a lamb for burnt offering. It has been pointed out that when Solomon's temple was built in Jerusalem, it is said that it was built, it was claimed that the altar of Solomon's temple stood on the same spot where Abraham had offered Isaac on the mountains of Moriah, which came to be called Mount Zion, this particular mountain. And we know that Jesus was crucified just outside Jerusalem in the same mountain range, right in the same area. That the offering of Isaac took place on the mountain of the Lord, where Jesus later was crucified. Now, it says in verse 14, Abram called the name of this place, the Lord will provide. You'll notice that is a portion of his prophecy in verse 8, my son, God will provide for himself a lamb for burnt offering. When we think of the name Jehovah Jireh, there's even a song made from it, Jehovah Jireh, my provider. The Lord will provide. We think of him providing for us. But Jehovah Jireh did not commemorate the fact that God provides for us, but rather that the Lord will provide for himself a lamb for a burnt offering. That's what the prophecy of Abraham was in verse 8. The Lord's going to provide for himself a lamb. And so he called the name of the place, the Lord will provide, as if to say, this is where God is going to provide the lamb for himself. And sure enough, Jesus, the Lamb of God, was crucified in the same mountains. Now, what's interesting is the last part of verse 14 says, as it is said to this day. Now, to this day means in Moses' day. Moses wrote this to his people of his time. And he's saying to them, to his contemporaries, Moses saying, even to this day there's this saying about that mountain. And the saying is, in the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. What shall be? The lamb that he predicted in verse 8. Abraham predicted that God would provide a lamb. And then he predicted that it would be on this mountain, in this place called the Lord shall provide. And so Moses says, by way of commentary and telling this story, Moses says to the people of his time, even to this day, hundreds of years later in Moses' time, even to this day there's a saying about this, that in the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. Which means that in the days after Abraham's time, even in Moses' time, it was not thought that the ram caught in the thicket was the fulfillment of Abraham's prediction. But they anticipated a yet future fulfillment, that on the mountain of the Lord God had yet to provide a lamb for a burnt offering. And of course that lamb that was provided was Jesus. And there was an expectation of that from the time of Abraham on, that on that very mountain God would provide a sacrifice lamb for himself. Verse 15. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, says the Lord. The writer of Hebrews makes a point of saying that when people swear oaths, they usually swear by something greater than themselves. He brings this up in Hebrews 6, verses 13 and 14. And the writer of Hebrews there in Hebrews 6, 13 and 14 says, but because God couldn't swear by anything greater than himself, he just swore by himself. And he quotes this verse as an evidence that God swore, he couldn't swear by anything greater than himself. Men always swear by something greater than themselves. But there's nothing greater than himself, so God just swore by himself. By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. In blessing I will bless you. In multiplying I will multiply you. Your descendants, as the stars of the heaven and as the sand of the seashore, I will multiply your descendants, as the stars of the heaven and as the sand of the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. Possessing the gate of the enemies means that you've taken the city. The gate is the vulnerable spot of a walled city, and to take the gates is to gain access. When you're invading a city, you take the gates and you've got the city. So basically saying your offspring will have victory over their enemies. In your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. So Abram returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abram dwelt at Beersheba. It's a little hard to know exactly what is meant in verse 70, where it says, in blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply you. It may be just a Hebraism that means I'm going to bless you and keep blessing. I'm going to multiply you and keep multiplying. Or it might mean that as I am in the business of multiplying and blessing people, I will bless and multiply you. That in blessing, I will bless you. That is, as I'm in the process of blessing folks, you'll certainly get a blessing. And in multiplying folks, I'll multiply you. There's a third possibility. Some have thought it meant that as Abraham multiplies, as Abraham is in the act of multiplying, God will multiply him. And as Abraham is blessing others, that God will bless him. The phrases are difficult to know exactly the meaning, but obviously, short of being certain of the exact meaning of this of the phrase, it's clear that God is saying that Abram's going to be blessed and multiplied. His children will not only be numerous, but will be victorious over their enemies, and all the nations of the earth will be blessed through his seed, which is, of course, Christ, as we know from the New Testament. Now, verse 20, now it came to pass after these things that it was told Abram, saying, indeed, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor. Now, we haven't heard of them for a long time. That was back in chapter 11. Haran died. Milcah was the orphan daughter. Lot was the orphan son. Milcah was Lot's sister. Milcah married her uncle Nahor. And now, for the first time, 25 years later or more, Abraham hears what's happened in the family. Milcah has had some children. Huz, the firstborn, and Buz, his brother. Kemuel, the father of Aram. Chazed, Pildash, Jidlaf, and Bethuel. Now, Bethuel begot Rebekah, and these eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abram's brother. His concubine, whose name was Rumah, also bore Teba, Gaham, Thahash, and Maacah. That seems clear that we're reading history and not legends here to give the names of unimportant people like this just because it's true. You know, in stories that are made up for fiction, you don't have a lot of detail about characters that don't have any role in the story. But this is just, it just has the marks of just being a historical account. These are the names. Who cares? You know, I mean, we'll never know who these people were. They don't come into the story ever. It just happens that they are part of the family and they're mentioned briefly. But of course there is at least one person mentioned in this lineage from Nahor and Milcah that is significant. And that is Rebekah in verse 23. Bethuel begot Rebekah. And this is said by way of anticipation of chapter 24. Because after we get Sarah dead and buried in chapter 23, the only thing that remains for Abram to do is to get a wife for Isaac. And in chapter 24, we read how he sends his servant back to his to Haran, where and back to where Nahor's family was. And lo and behold, the Lord directs Rebekah to him, and Rebekah becomes the wife of Isaac. So Rebekah was really, let's see here, I'm trying to figure this out. I think Rebekah was a great-granddaughter. Yeah, the great-granddaughter of Nahor. So she was three generations removed from Abram, where Isaac was one generation removed. Isaac was, Abram's son, and he married his dad's brother's great-granddaughter. But remember, Isaac was born very late in his father's life, and so their ages, Rebekah's and Isaac's, might not have been quite as great, because Nahor may have been having his children more at regular, early in life, where Isaac was born when his dad was 100 years old. So there wouldn't be the huge gap that there might otherwise be with a guy marrying his great-great-great niece or something, as in this case, or cousin, or zillionth cousin, whatever the relationship is. Okay, now, we will have Sarah leave the picture now in chapter 23. Sarah lived 127 years. She's the only woman in the Bible whose age at time of death is given. We do read of the death of other women, and we do read of the ages of very many men at the time of their death, very commonly, but this is the only woman whose age at the time of her death is given, which suggests, you know, that she's more important than most, that they give more detail like this. 127 years old. Isaac obviously was almost 40 at that time. These were the years of the life of Sarah. So Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abraham stood up from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth. The sons of Heth are also known in Scripture as the Hittites. They were a Canaanite nation in Canaan. And he said to the Hittite men, "I am a foreigner and a sojourner among you. Give me property for a burial place among you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight." And the sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, "Hear us, my lord. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our burial places. None of us will withhold from you his burial place, that you may bury your dead." Now, Abraham has a bit of a problem. He's never had to bury anyone before. He's had to dig wells before, but he could do that in no man's land. A well is one thing. It's important to sustain life, but a burial ground is sacred. I mean, you want to bury your relatives in a place where someone's not going to come digging them up just because they don't know they're there. Or, you know, someone digs a well through their corpse or something. You know, I mean, just you need a sacred place set apart where your dead can rest in peace and not be disturbed. I'm not saying we really need that now. But in those days, burial places were sacred, and it was not far more important than a well. He didn't have to own all the land around a well. The fact that he dug a well meant that he had water rights, but he didn't have to own the property around it. But a burial place he has to own so that no one else will violate it. No one else will do any. Someone won't build a condominium on top of it or something. He has to obtain land rights. He's got to own the real estate. And Abraham has been in the land she was 65 when they went in the land, so he's been there for 62 years now. And he's never owned any land. Even though God has promised that the whole land is going to be owned by him and his descendants, after him, he has not owned so much as a square foot until now. And yet now he's got a situation that has never arisen before. He's got to bury somebody. He's got to own some property. So he buys it. Now, at a later date, Joshua would come in and drive out all the Hittites and take their land by force. But Abram wasn't in a position to do that at this point. He had to buy it with money from them. So he has to secure land, and this land that he bought on this occasion is the only land he ever owned in his lifetime in the land of Canaan. And it turned out to be a field with a cave that was suitable for burying, and both Abraham and Sarah were buried there, as well as Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob and Leah, and possibly Joseph also. We're not sure where he ended up being buried. But the point is, this story is given in this chapter in order to mention the only piece of land in the Promised Land that Abram ever owned and how he came to buy it. So he comes to the sons of Heth and wants to bargain to buy some property. He asks them to sell him some. I was reading the journals of Jim Elliot, and part of those, he was actually, part of his life, he was reading through Genesis and making his own devotional comments on it. And he made an interesting observation on this story. He pointed out that it was not when Abram was seeing himself as a great one, that the Hittites saw him as a great one, but when he confessed himself in verse 4 to be a foreigner and a sojourner, that the world confessed him to be a mighty prince among them in verse 6. See, he said in verse 4, I'm a foreigner and a sojourner among you. And they said in verse 6, you're a mighty prince among us. He spoke not of himself as someone important, not someone impressive. He's just a traveler. He's just a vagrant. He's just passing through their land. They said, no, you're not. You're a mighty prince. And the point being made here by Jim Elliot was that when Christians try to seek heirs and status and glories in the world, first of all, they're not viewing the fact correctly. They are, in fact, we are strangers and pilgrims in the world. Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 2, I beseech you, therefore, as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts that war against the soul. We are strangers and pilgrims here. But when we try to compete with the world for glory and power and prestige and political position and all that stuff, and we act like we're an integral part of the world rather than strangers and pilgrims in it, the world doesn't admire us. They just see us as competitors. They just see us as someone to overcome. But when we see ourselves as we truly are, as citizens of another planet, as it were, we're invaders from outer space. Our citizenship is in heaven. And we're strangers and pilgrims here. We're just ambassadors here. And as we live loyal to God, loyal to the kingdom that we belong to, rather than trying to obtain position and possession in this land, and that's when the world looks on and says, the church really is distinctive. The church really, these really are the children of God. I mean, our holiness is more clearly seen when we're not trying to be impressive in the sight of the world, but when we're trying to impress God only. We see ourselves as strangers here. That's when the world recognizes that the church is a mighty force in the world, when it really is holy, when it really is not trying to follow the same agendas as the world, but it's we're just passing through here, and we live by standards of our own. There's a group of people in the book of Jeremiah, the Rechabites, son of a guy named Jonadab, who lived outside Jerusalem. They were apparently Jewish people by blood. But they never settled, and they never would own property. And to tell you the truth, I'm not sure if I can find that chapter immediately off the top of my head. It's in Jeremiah. It is chapter 35. And the Rechabites, 200 years earlier, one of their ancestors, a guy named Jonadab, had told them to never buy property, never settle in the city, never drink wine, never plant vineyards. And here, 200 years later, his descendants are still obeying his commands, and they're strangers and pilgrims unsettled around there. And actually, God speaks well of them because they kept their father's instructions. You can read Jeremiah 35 on your own if it interests you. It is an interesting chapter because God says, you know, how come these Rechabites follow the instructions of their ancestor and my people don't follow my instructions? And the Rechabites were told to remain pilgrims and Bedouins and strangers and not to settle in, and they didn't. And therefore they remained uncorrupted. But when the world's allurements attract the church, and the church wants to be a Canaanite too, wants to be part of Canaan, part of Canaanite culture, then far from being impressed with us, the Canaanites simply conclude that there's nothing distinctive about us at all. But it's because Abram remained aloof, lived by his own standards, the blessing of God was on him because he lived wholly unto the Lord, that those who looked on said, oh, this man's a mighty prince. He's an important person. He's distinctive. And they acknowledged it. Then Abraham stood up and bowed himself, verse 7, to the people of the land, the sons of Heth, and he spoke with them, saying, if it is your wish that I bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and meet with Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me. This was one of the Hittite men. That he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he has, which is at the end of his field. Let him give it to me at the full price as property for a burial place among you. Now Ephron dwelt among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the presence of the sons of Heth, all who entered at the gate of his city. Now this, we're not told before, but this transaction was taking place at the gate of the city where legal transactions would always happen. And he answered in public before the judges and so forth, "No, my Lord, hear me. I give you the field and the cave that is in it. I give it to you in the presence of the sons of my people. I give it to you. Bury your dead." Then Abraham bowed himself down before the people of the land, and he spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, "If you will give it, please hear me. I will give you money for the field. Take it from me, and I will bury my dead there." And Ephron answered Abraham, saying to him, "My Lord, listen to me. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. What is that between you and me? So bury your dead." And Abram listened to Ephron, and Abram weighed out the silver for Ephron, which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, currency of the merchants. So the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field and the cave which was in it, and all the trees that were in the field, which were within all the surrounding borders, were deeded to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth, before all who went in at the gate of his city. And after this, Abram buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, before Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded to Abraham by the sons of Heth as property for a burial place. Now, there's an awful lot in this chapter that looks like it's a legal document. It talks about, you know, in the presence of these witnesses, this, the land, all the trees that are in it, and the cave. You know, it sounds like a legal document defining what was purchased and for what price and from whom and so forth. And it was deeded properly in the presence of the judges and so forth. And there's a lot more detail on this transaction than perhaps we are interested in knowing. But it seems as if when Moses included this chapter, he may have actually had a copy of the deed, and the actual wording of the deed has found its way into the way the story is told. Now, the transaction between Ephron and Abraham makes it sound like Ephron's a really generous guy. Abraham says, "I've been checking out the property, and the property I like the best is this guy Ephron's field over here called Machpelah. It's got a cave just right for my purposes to bury my dead there." And Ephron says, "You can have it." He says it in front of everyone, in front of all the people of the land and the gates of the city. This is a legal conversation going on with public witnesses. And he says, "You can have it. Just take it and bury your dead." Now, you might think, wow, that guy's really generous giving this real estate to Abraham. But actually, it is now known, because archaeologists have found a great deal of Hittite civilization and a lot of documents from it, that this was a normal way of transacting business like this. The man, when he said, "Take it," did not intend at all for Abram to accept that offer. This was part of the protocol of polite transactions. You first offer it for free, but the guy better not accept it for free, or you'll probably make war with him, because he's supposed to say, "Oh, no, I would never take it for free. I want to pay you money." And then you say, "Oh, well, if you insist on paying money, then it's worth this much." That's how it was always done. I remember when I was single, I lived with another single guy who was from another culture. And I noticed that every time I came in the house, if he was cooking, which was often the case, he'd offer me food. I'd usually have eaten or had plans to eat somewhere else, so I'd generally turn him down. I'd say, "No, thanks." But then a few minutes later, he'd offer me food again. I'd say, "No, that's okay, thanks." And then third time, he'd come and offer me food again. I'd say, "Listen, you've already asked me. No, thanks. I'm not hungry. Thanks." And then he'd stop asking. And after a while, I asked him why he always did that. He always did that. And he said, "Well, where I come from, when you have a guest over, you're supposed to offer him food, but it's considered impolite for them to accept it the first time you offer. And if they really want it, you have to offer it twice, and they can accept it on the second or third invitation. But if they accept the offer too soon, it's considered impolite." So even though apparently in that culture, you say, "No, thank you, I'm not hungry," you really are hungry, and you're really hoping they will give you some, but you're supposed to, just out of politeness, lie. And, you know, it's strange how some cultures are that way. It's true in the Canaanite culture and many Middle Eastern cultures. This is how they would do things. "I want to buy something from you." "Just take it. It's yours." "No, I insist. I want to buy it." "Well, okay, it's worth this much money." And then you pay the money. That's just the way they did it. But you don't dare accept their first offer of free. That's just showing, they're supposed to show how magnanimous they are. That way they can charge anything they want. No one can say, what a greedy person. I offered him for free. You know, I'm not a greedy person. But then they can ask what they want. What did he ask for? 400 shekels of silver. I read somewhere in a commentary that the average laborer made something like 8 shekels or 15 shekels a year of silver. Something like that. I think it was 8 shekels. 6 to 8 shekels a year was what a person generally made in that time and in that culture. This says that. You see different things. I read a commentary that said one thing, and you've got something else there. Now, see, that doesn't sound very expensive, $700 and something. Now, see, I guess you have to judge by... Now, when your Bible says 700, you know, they're talking about probably the price of that much weight of shekel now, of silver. I mean, whenever that Bible was published, there was a price of silver per ounce. I don't know how many ounces a shekel is. Does your Bible say? Some Bibles would probably say. They have tables of measures and weights and stuff in the back of some study Bibles. But I honestly don't know how many ounces of silver there are in a shekel. But your Bible that puts that price on it probably figures, well, there's X number of ounces in a shekel. And by today's silver prices, that would be a total of $700 and something for that many ounces of silver. But see, silver prices go up and down, as do gold prices. And it may be, in fact, that the same amount of silver that Abram paid would cost $700 and something today. But that may not change the fact that back then people only made 6 or 7 shekels a year, because prices being different, I mean, purchasing power being different, it'd be like comparing apples and oranges. Sarah, did you have some information on that?
0.4 ounces for common shekel and 0.8 ounces for gold shekel.
4 ounces for common, 0.8 for a royal?
Yeah, it's 11.4 grams for
0.4
ounces.
0.4 ounces. So that's not even a whole ounce. That's half an ounce or less. Yeah, see, that doesn't make sense that half an ounce of silver would be worth $700, because silver's never been that expensive. Even gold has never been that expensive per half an ounce. Another Bible says about 10 pounds. So you've got, it's either... 0.4 of an ounce, or it's 10 pounds.
Well,
the 400 would be? Oh, okay, that makes a difference then. Okay, that would make sense. Then it is about 0.4. It is then about 0.4 ounce, I guess. Or something. Well, obviously, we're getting a lot of different standards here. And that is what I have found over the years, reading commentaries and these charts of weights and measures in the back of Bibles. They don't all agree. I noticed that 20 years ago in comparing different Bible standards. So I don't usually try to translate it into modern weights and measures, because there's so many different opinions about what a shekel was in those days and so forth. But suffice it to say that any evaluation that a modern Bible might put on that would be based on how much weight of silver there was and the value of silver today and so forth, if they're going to try to put in modern American dollars. But that would not be a true measure of its buying power. 4,000 years ago when Abraham was on the earth. I mean, the purchasing power of an ounce of silver might have been, you know, like 100 times as much as it is now back then. We don't know. But nonetheless, apparently there are some records, according to some commentators, and we know there's a lot of Hittite records have been dug up from some source. I assume from such a source as that, someone found the average laborer made 6 to 8 shekels a year, which would mean that the guy was really asking a pretty high price. He wasn't all that generous. And Abraham paid it without bickering. He just figured out, he's a rich man. He can pay whatever he wants. If it was millions of dollars, he could have paid it. And he had to pay whatever they'd charge. He was not in a bargaining position. He had no real estate, and he had a dead body reeking, you know, rotting there in the sun. He had to bury, and so he had to pay whatever was asked, and that's what he did pay, a lot. I think it was a lot. Let's look at chapter 24. Now, we only have 7 minutes, and it's a very long chapter, but the reason it's so long is there's a lot of repetition. It tells a story, and then it tells the same story again when the man gets there and tells what happened. We may not get through all this in this session, because I'm going to quit before the tape ends, but we'll just see what we can do here. Now, Abraham was old, well advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. So Abram said to the oldest servant of his house, who ruled over all that he had, please put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, that the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. But you shall go to my country, to my kindred, and take a wife for my son Isaac. And the servant said to him, perhaps the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I take your son back to the land from which you came? And Abram said to him, beware that you do not take my son back there. The Lord God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, and who spoke to me and swore to me, saying, to your descendants I give this land, he will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife of my son from there. And if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be not released from this oath. Only do not take my son back there. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. This servant is not named, but it's possible that this was Eliezer, the man who had been the oldest servant many years earlier when God complained that, or Abraham complained to God that he didn't have a son and that Eliezer, his oldest servant, was the heir of his things. We aren't told that this was Eliezer, and Eliezer, who had once been the oldest servant, might be dead by now, and this might be a different servant who had risen to that rank. But he was a trusted servant, and Abraham even trusted this delicate task of picking a wife for his son to him, though he gave him strict restrictions. Can't be a Canaanite woman. Their religions were too utterly corrupt. Didn't want Isaac going back to the land of Abram's ancestors, lest he be comfortable there and settle there and lose interest in the land of Canaan, which God had promised to him. Isaac has to stay in Canaan, but the wife has to come from someone not too far distant related. Remember, there were no Jews. Everybody married Gentiles in those days because there weren't any Jews. So Isaac had to marry a Gentile woman. But at least Abraham's family had known about Jehovah. And although Terah had worshipped other gods too, the name of Jehovah was known to the people who were the family of Abraham. And so he hoped to find a woman who shared the same religious convictions, or at least basically, as he did for his son. It would not be appropriate for his son to marry a Canaanite or someone who had different religion. The Bible is not opposed to interracial marriage. It never forbids it. But it is opposed to interreligious marriage, for people of different religions to marry one another. The Jews were never permitted to marry people who were of another religion, though they'd sometimes married, well, like Ruth was a Moabite. She married a Jew and became grandmother of David. But she converted to Judaism before she married the Jew. It's not the racial difference. It's the religious difference that matters. And so it was important for this man to find a woman of the right religion. And to do that, it seemed almost necessary to go back to Abram's own relatives. The servant wasn't sure he'd be able to be successful. But Abram said, the angel of the Lord will go ahead of you and he'll prepare the way for you. And certainly that did materialize. Putting his hand under his thigh, just an ancient Oriental custom for taking an oath. I don't understand exactly its significance, but that's what happened. He put his hand under his thigh and took an oath. Verse 10, and the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, for all his master's goods were in his hand, and he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. And he made his camels kneel down outside the city by a well of water at the evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. Then he said, O Lord God of my master Abraham, please give me success this day, and show kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I stand here by the well of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now let it be that the young woman to whom I say, please let down your pitcher that I may drink, and she says, drink, and I will also give your camels a drink. Let her be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master. So he basically asked for a sign. He doesn't want to get the wrong girl. And so he asked God to direct the right girl to him at the right time. And this is sort of like a countersign, sort of like secret agents used to have. You know, I'll say this, and if they say this, then I'll know that's the person I'm supposed to be making contact with. And so it happened before he had finished speaking that, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abram's brother, came out with her pitcher on her shoulder. Now the young woman was very beautiful to behold, a virgin, no man had known her, and she went down to the well, filled her pitcher, and came up. And the servant ran to meet her and said, please let me drink a little water from your pitcher. So she said, drink, my lord. Then she hastened and let her pitcher down to her hand and gave him a drink. And when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking. Then she hastened and emptied her pitcher into the trough, ran back to the well to draw water, and drew for all his camels. And the man wondered at her, remaining silent, so as to know whether the Lord had made his journey prosperous or not. I wonder how he could even wonder. Camels drink what? 50 gallons, and he had 10 of them, and she's got a bucket, and she and they've just traveled 3 weeks across the desert. They're empty. To fill her up in a case like that might be 500 gallons of water she's got to draw, and she volunteers and she runs to do it. She's in a, you know, it's she's not slow about it. She's a diligent, hardworking servant girl, beautiful virgin girl. He doesn't know yet who she is. He doesn't know that she's also about as closely related as Abraham and Isaac as he could wish for anyone to be. We're going to have her interrupt the story at this point, sadly, because the time is up. But we will continue it next time, and we'll see how it turns out and what its significance may be spiritually with reference to Christ and the church, which is a possibly a type of that. But we'll have to do this unnatural thing and stop at this point and pick it up later.